Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Panel: Important Developments in Laboratory Legal, Regulatory, and Compliance Requirements. The presenters are Charles Dunham, shareholder, Greenberg Traurig, LLP, Houston, Texas, Keith Lefkowitz, attorney, Hendershot Cowart PC, Houston, Texas, Karen Lovitch, partner, Mintz, Washington, D.C., and Danielle Sloan, partner, Bass, Barry and Sims, Nashville, Tennessee.
I think we can get started now. Your group of attorneys here will be giving you a great deal of information today. I just want to remind everybody that the WOVA application has a place where you can put in questions. If you don't have a chance to ask your questions now or if you want to answer them later, Charles in particular, I know, will make sure that he answers any questions that get put on there. I will let them know when their time is running out, and other than that, I leave it over to them.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Great attendance. Great to see. And we appreciate the responses to the app and survey. It helps us modify what we were going to present. In fact, the two primary topics that we're going to start off with, we've flipped them to make sure that we address the things that you want to hear about and learn about. We're going to essentially spread this out so everyone's going to have an opportunity to comment on these topics. I'll start by introducing myself and my other panelists introduce themselves as well. My name is Charles Dunham. I'm a corporate healthcare attorney for Greenberg Traurig in our Houston office. We have offices all over the U.S. and internationally, but I have focused a significant part of my practice on working with labs and path groups, you know, across the country for about 15 years now. And like my co-panelists here, spend a lot of my time in a multitude of areas from transactional and M&A, corporate compliance, regulatory billing and coding, and fraud and abuse, white-collar civil and criminal matters. So come at it with a lot of different perspectives in issues that you're dealing with. Danielle?
Thanks. I'm Danielle Sloan. I'm a healthcare attorney at Bass, Berry & Sims based out of Nashville, Tennessee. My practice focuses, I consider myself a regulatory attorney, which means I work on a lot of compliance, reimbursement, and fraud and abuse issues. Sometimes that applies in transactions, sometimes that applies in investigations. I like to joke with my healthcare fraud colleagues that my goal is to prevent you from ever needing them in general. Try to resolve things in the front end so you don't have to worry about those types of things. I've worked with lab companies for the last 15 years. It's just an area that I really enjoy. I'm a biology degree undergrad, and so I just really appreciate the science behind it. Not that I keep up with it at all. You still have to explain it to me on some level. But one thing that was noted earlier that I just wanted to mention, there's been a lot of conversation about value-based care. Another part of my practice I've really been doing a lot lately is value-based care arrangements. And so as you all consider those types of things, and that's not really something we're talking about today, but an area that lab and diagnostics have really started to come up as a big issue because they help reduce the cost of care, ultimately, as we talked about. So that's me. Karen?
Hi, I'm Karen Lovitch, and I'm chair of the health law practice and co-chair of the healthcare enforcement defense practice at a law firm called Mintz, and I'm based in the Washington, D.C. office. My practice is somewhat similar to Danielle's in that at my core, I'm a healthcare regulatory but also fraud and abuse lawyer. And over the years, I have really specialized in representing labs and diagnostic companies. I think I'm the elder statesperson on this panel. I've been working with labs now for, I'm scared to say this out loud, over 25 years. And I'm sure many of you know Hope Foster, and I learned everything I know from her. So just looking forward to being on this panel, and I'm, like, shocked there are so many people who want to talk to lawyers. And there are also, if anybody wants to sit down, there are a couple seats up here in the front of the class. We won't call on you, I promise.
Hi, I'm Keith Lefkowitz. I'm an attorney out of Houston, Texas. I'm based with Hendershot & Carrot PC. We're a transactional business litigation law firm. Before starting there, I got my background in lab, in-house, got to see deal-making, how the sausage was made on the inside, working with business stakeholders, from a regulatory compliance role. I would say I'm mostly focused on front-end business development, regulatory compliance, like Danielle and others said, keep everybody away from litigation and investigations, but also happy to be here and excited for this very huge panel.
Thank you all. So we'll start with regulatory compliance issues. As a lot of you had responded, you want to have some feedback on specific types of referral arrangements, specifically in compliance and fraud and abuse on that standpoint. And the two that we identified is the first that we'll start with is, and I'm switching the order a bit, but is the digital marketplace piece, or what we referred to as the digital marketplace. The platforms that are otherwise being utilized in order for physicians and other types of referring providers to identify laboratories that are actually in network with their patient populations. And so there's a history of advisory opinions out there that from the Office of Inspector General that relate to these types of platforms, whether they're for physician services or otherwise ancillary services and the like. So I'll give the floor over to Keith to briefly describe that in the context of the lab space, as well as give us his thoughts on a piece of the puzzle with advisory opinions and some of the factors that you take into consideration.
Absolutely. So when we talk about digital marketing, as Charles said, there's a history of different advisory opinions you want to take a look at to evaluate your regulatory risks. There have been some very favorable advisory opinions. There's also been there's been some case law and other issues where courts may determine that the plain reading of the NKPAC statute might prohibit certain digital marketplace activities with auction and percentage-based commissions. The advisory opinion that we were going to focus on before talking about digital marketing was really the technical component purchase.
Well, that's different.
Okay, I got a little switched up there. So there has been some advisory opinions on the digital marketing space, allowing for. Sorry, Danielle.
Yeah, I think that was my topic.
Got a little switch here.
I'm going to give you a hard time. You weren't prepared for it. So the digital marketing place issue has come up a lot recently, not just in labs, really in anything else, using these sort of industry platforms to connect people who want lab tests with individuals. And they're sort of, under the anti-kickback statute, as you all sort of are probably very familiar with, the issues with commission-based sales compensation from 1099 W-2, considering ECRA, it sort of bleeds into these arrangements because the anti-kickback statute prohibits any like payments related to referring, arranging, or recommending services, right? And so putting certain lab tests on a platform and not other lab tests, you can see how there's sort of an issue there, particularly if they're getting paid a percentage of the revenues that the lab is receiving. And so there is something under anti-kickback called the referral services safe harbor. That is designed to sort of protect literally called referral services, but it's very narrow. It protects payments between a referral service provider and the participants. So in this case, the labs would be the participants, and some technology company would probably be the provider. But it requires everyone who meets the eligibility standards to open up to everyone, so it can't be exclusive to certain providers. All participants have to pay the exact same rate, right, so you're not preferentially treating somebody, and that rate can only be based on the cost of operating the referral service and not the volume of value of the referrals or the business generated that's covered by federal healthcare programs. So obviously percentage based compensation is not going to touch on that. And ultimately, the situations that have come to me involve a company that wants to sort of combine marketing and these platforms. And there are several advisory opinions out there. Some of them are literally just focused on, like, banner advertisements, internet advertisements, where, like, an advertiser like Google gets paid per click, you know, when someone clicks on the advertisement. But there are other ones that are more focused. In fact, there's two particular, 1904 and 2304, both positive, that deal with sort of a technology company proposing to operate a free online directory. So think of this situation where you're looking for, like, a cardiologist, and you're going to get on and you're going to look on Google, and you're going to put in, like, your insurer and the geographic area that you're looking for, and maybe if they have availability in the next, like, 3 weeks or something. And it's going to pop up with results. Those types of things, these advisory opinions are addressing, but some of the reasons that the OIG got comfortable with them are particularly any advertising being completely passive in nature, and that the individual's really assertively going to these platforms as opposed to them coming to the individuals, right? And so I've seen the digital marketplace in the lab context specifically, but to date, really only focused on cash pay, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, because unable to sort of get comfortable from either an ACAS standpoint or an ECRA standpoint on doing some sort of commission or per-test payments with the marketing components and combined with these. And obviously the lab industry, probably more than anybody else, has taken sort of big hits for using any sort of percentage-based compensation schemes. Scheme's probably the wrong word, but and there's several other opinions. There's one about a cardiology group. There's one about home health services. But these seem to be popping up a lot more, and I would expect them to continue to do so because it makes a lot of sense to use technology in this way, especially given the breadth of lab tests that are out there and wanting to connect the right tests to the right patient and, you know, and combining those information. So you just have to be thoughtful about how you do it. So I would, you know, encourage you to, like, think thoughtfully and, you know, not just sign those contracts, because let me tell you, some of these startup technology companies, I have seen some of the worst contracts I've ever seen in my life. And you are, like, signing away your firstborn child and everything else. And you just want to make sure it's set up correctly.
So I'll touch upon a few things, because we know the OIG obviously does not like, they like things to be simple when they're trying to enforcement actions, right? So, or even DOJ. So it's, you know, when they see a per test or certainly a percentage of, you know, revenues, it sort of, that sets off the red flags. And as Danielle was pointing out, to, you know, structuring it in a way that doesn't have those elements to it. We even saw it with the advisory opinion with an old issue with the processing and handling fees. Mm-hmm. Essentially, they basically said, hey, yeah, actually, we think you could structure a processing and handling fee within the personal services management contract safe harbor, but because it's still a per test, we don't like it. Well, the problem is, you know, in 2021, the anti-kickback statute was, MC was reframed to allow it to comply with Stark just the same way, right? That it was service-based. It really would be allowed if you were in that criteria to meet that that framework. So even, unfortunately, one of the things to take away was really considering those types of arrangements, because even if you can click off all that criteria, the OIG or DOJ is still scrutinizing these relationships simply because of the framework of a per test, and certainly on a percentage of collections, but not on a per test piece. Karen?
Well, I was going to say just really quickly, I mean, I think the bottom line is you can never lose sight of the fact that the anti-kickback statute and ECRA go beyond just paying a doctor to refer tests to you. Anytime you're working with another company or individual who is promoting your product, those laws are going to come into play. Now, maybe if it's cash pay, as, you know, Danielle points out, it might not. But just don't, you know, you have to be thinking about the fraud and abuse laws whenever you're getting into any sort of arrangement that involves sales, marketing, advertising, et cetera.
But I think it's important to acknowledge that advisory opinions, right, that's guidance, and it's really helpful from a criminal perspective on a regulatory compliance. But as we'll probably later get to SNG Labs and Schema, you know, there's also this other component of enforceability of your contracts. And in the digital marketplace, there is a case out there of MedPrices versus Becton Dickinson, and you know, that dealt with percentage-based compensation as far as medical suppliers, and the court found that that agreement did violate the potentially violated the terms of the anti-kickback statute in order to void that contract. So when you think about your business startups or your contractual relationships on the front end, it's both regulatory compliance, looking at advisory opinions for you know, potential criminal investigation, but also just enforceability for your revenue streams on a go-forward basis.
All right, we'll transition to the topic of the TC purchase arrangements and the advisory opinion 2203 that many of you may be familiar with. I'll turn it over to Keith to summarize in the high level of the advisory opinion, and we can all share our comments on it.
High level overview of this advisory opinion: you have the purchase of technical component in order to allow one group of labs to get access to, this of course is coming from the opinion or the perspective of the OIG who wrote the opinion. It's purchasing of the technical component to give access to billing of third-party payers. When we talk about, before we're talking about, you know, percentage-based commission, that's, you know, that's historically been an issue for the OIG. What's really significant about this opinion is the commercially reasonableness of the deal. Are you entering into the deal for some legitimate business purpose other than revenue generation, right? Other than for the generation of the referrals from the from the labs that you're acquiring the technical component for, or is it needed to perform some function of your business to deliver some component of your healthcare, or is the true purpose to generate that referral? And that comes to the judicially created one purpose test. If you're ever caught in an investigation and it goes to judicial review, if one purpose of the arrangement is for that referral relationship, even if you have legitimate services that were provided and even if your compensation was for fair market value, it could still be found in violation of the anti-kickback statute.
Yeah, and I guess I would just add about those arrangements. So I think a lot of people did not necessarily agree with the way the OIG analyzed those arrangements. And the OIG focused on, so the arrangements were a lab buys, well, in the opinion it was a lab, pathology lab buys the technical component from either a physician office lab or another lab not affiliated with the physician office. And then so the lab would buy the technical, and then the lab would bill for both the technical and the professional. And so the OIG's issue was, well, you're only doing that because you want to get the other business that physician office or lab can't, isn't going to bill themselves like the federal healthcare program business. And in the opinion, part of the problem was that the lab who was buying the services could have performed those services itself cheaper. And so, in other words, I mean, it sort of leaves you with the conclusion, unspoken conclusion, that, well, why would you do that except to get other business? Now, I can offer some reasons why. But regardless, I mean, my issue with that opinion was I don't see how you can lump physician offices, buying from a physician office, in with buying from another lab. I mean, that's just like two totally different things and two totally different sets of motivation. And so while I would say that the opinion with respect to the physician offices is consistent with how I've always viewed those arrangements, I do not think arrangements between two labs raise the same set of issues. But we're just kind of stuck with it.
I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the requester wanted to get a negative advisory opinion, right? And that seems to happen more in the lab space than
yes,
elsewhere.
It does. It does.
I have reviewed a lot of pathology arrangements, and sometimes they are so fact-dependent and nuanced that to me, the thing that called out is, like, how can you just sort of characterize them all as sort of the same, to Karen's point? I think the other thing is a lot of times when a lab is referring out some work to another lab outside of the physician office lab context, it has nothing to do with federal healthcare program referrals, right? Like they can perform them themselves. They just can't get in network with whatever payer. So there's probably plenty of commercial reasonability. They probably are servicing a client. They get the samples in, you know, and they like can't process these, or they're not going to get paid for them, or they have to bill out of network. So they're sending them on to somebody else, and they want to get credit for like a little bit of what they had to do. There's all sorts of issues with this opinion. I think it's very, like, you know, but so you sort of have to take it for what it is. Someone certified it wasn't commercially reasonable. Once you certify it's not commercially reasonable, I don't know how you get a positive opinion. So it was sort of, you know, baked from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'd touch upon there is I agree with that baked from the beginning, because the requester specifically said all of the commercially reasonable basis for otherwise entering into that arrangement didn't exist. But, yeah, I mean, within that opinion, and the thing to take out of there was not as typically, as you would commonly see in the OIG opinions, is they did not take the position that it is impermissible, that they're dealing with a specific fact pattern that they were given by a requester, and that's all that they work within, right? So understanding the arrangements that you're entering into, what the basis is for entering into those, and what really, and meeting all of that criteria, again, of the personal services, you know, safe harbor. But again, what really stood out to me is what I know is being leaned on more and more and focused in more and more from an enforcement standpoint is not the fair market value piece of the puzzle. You can get a right, you know, agreement in writing, so on and so forth. It's really understanding the commercially reasonableness of entering into your arrangements, similar to, say, like when you're saying, oh, I need to put somebody on my advisory board. Should I hire this physician? Well, why do you need an advisory board? For what purpose? Why do you need that specific physician who may or may not be referring? So just really thinking about each arrangement, as Karen was saying, it's not just the payment directly to the referring provider, but those relationships, what you're entering into, and commercially reasonableness is going to be a focus, from both the federal and state level of enforcement.
And can I add, just for anybody who doesn't know, commercial reasonableness is really the reason why you're doing the arrangement. Like, what is the legitimate business purpose that you have that's not paying for referrals, right? And so you want to document that contemporaneously with entering into the relationship, so that you have that, well, this is why we did it, and this is why it made sense for our organization.
All right, so we're going to jump to the second topic that was most highly voted upon to talk about was what I call consumer-initiated healthcare. A lot of folks refer to it as direct-to-consumer. Earlier in a number of different discussions, there was a lot of topic raised about commercial labs entering into those arrangements. Either they're offering those services directly to individuals out in the market, or they're contracting with, a telemedicine or a telehealth platform to be able to do that. I know we all have dealt with these arrangements and thinking through them, but the thing that I wanted to touch upon, and I'll turn it over to other topics, is interestingly enough, with the advent of and what we saw to be this final rule with LDTs, and everyone's going to be like, oh, LDTs. Well, actually, for me, it has an import because I'll be speaking actually at ATA next in a few days about these topics. But the at-home collection kits, that component by which it is imperative to be able for telehealth, telemedicine, or any type of remote care to exist, right? Ordering tests, getting test results, or prescribing medications, all of these things. The collection kits themselves have, in the same vein, been more so hands-off enforcement discretion by the FDA. There is an entire regulatory framework that exists for collection kits. It literally is defined in the CFR what a collection kit is, how it has multiple components of medical devices. There are guidance that says you have to have a UDI for these collection kits, even though they're made up of and packaged of medical devices that are already approved. So I feel that this might be that point where that enforcement discretion on that that ends. And specifically, if we were thinking about, and someone had suggested the bad eggs out there, or the those who they believe, the FDA believes has, you know, tests that are questionable, that might be one of the first areas where they start to go and target, because the issue and the piece of the puzzle with collection kits is not something that would be part of any lawsuit that's out there with LDTs, and so that's one piece of the puzzle that and to be concerned with. And a lot of the labs, in my experience, are actually contracting with a platform that has its own collection kit. And they may or may not be going through the processes of validating that collection kit and that process with their tests. So highlighting that is something important. The other thing I wanted to highlight on that is the piece of the puzzle with New York CLEP and being able to lean on New York's and Wadsworth Center's, you know, approval of those tests. Historically, New York has rejected the ability to use collection kits. So there's not really any LDTs out there that New York's approved that has these collection kits. However, my understanding is that FDA told them to take hands off and not address the collection kit. So that's going to be an area that I think is of interest. And then the second piece that I find interesting in consumer-initiated testing is, again, the relationship that you have when you're contracting with the platforms, if you're not otherwise offering these services directly on your own website or through your own marketing activities, is there's still that component of data privacy. You have either yourself operating a lab or already subject to HIPAA, if you are submitting claims, electronic claims, and so on and so forth. And a lot of labs have said, well, we're not submitting claims. This is primarily cash pay in that piece. The only way for that data to not otherwise be subject to HIPAA is if you create yourself as a hybrid entity, which means bifurcating all of that data, keeping it in different systems, so on and so forth. It's not really practical. I've not seen a lab be able to implement that successfully. And the other piece, though, is those platforms that the labs are contracting with, they may or may not think that they're subject to HIPAA, but they 100% are subject to the FTC's breach notification rules and that framework, and there's been the additional release of those rules. So when you're engaging with those entities, when you're contracting with them, data privacy is a really important piece of the puzzle to make sure that they're doing the right things, that they have security measures and they have protocols for those activities. Danielle, I'll just turn it over, and we'll talk about use of consumer-initiated healthcare and both cash pay and now third-party payer market, which we do more and more.
As if you didn't already bring up enough laws, I have sort of three different areas that I think about when I think about consumer-initiated. And it's interesting because the laws sort of like bump up against each other, right? There's like FDA, and admittedly I haven't finished reading the final rule, but it does – footnote 21 mentions the specimen collection kit stuff. But if you're going direct to consumer, right, you're already out of the LDTs, so forget the grandfathering or relying on anything else, right? Like if you're going direct, historically what has kept you from being a direct consumer item under the FDA rules is the physician order, the practitioner order, right? And in that final rule, it's interesting the way the FDA says it, because it talks about they're supposed to be the learned intermediary, and they're translating for the patient. And I think there's been a lot of situations, and there's a lot of cases out there right now where a practitioner was just signing off, never really seeing the patient, not really thinking about how or communicating. And so arrangements where labs are, getting a physician order and, with an affiliated physician, you have to think about the FDA piece. But then you also have to think about the CLIA requirements and state lab licensing requirements, which often require a physician order, too. So are you relying on your medical director to make those orders to satisfy the state law requirements? And then, of course, is the reimbursement, right? Like, cash pay is one thing, but almost every payer, Medicare for certain, and most commercial payers require a treating physician or treating practitioner to order the test, somebody who is going to use the test results in the management of the patient. And so it's important if you're going to try to bill and, like, you're going to get audited to sort of be able to demonstrate, that the physicians who are ordering these tests are are, you know, really the physicians. They're not just some telemedicine physician sitting in Timbuktu who has no relationship with the patient. There's plenty of cases out there. So
can I just say something on that?
Yeah.
I mean, I have seen a number of labs try to skirt the whole, in the cash pay scenario, try to just skirt the whole consumer, you know, just go straight to consumer and avoid the whole physician order requirement by terming the testing wellness testing. I would say more often than not, what I see people calling wellness testing, it does not qualify as wellness testing. It qualifies as testing that, you know, is covered under CLIA and requires, you know, a physician order under state law. So if you're going to try to do, you know, get into the wellness testing business, I would be, you know, I would definitely, you know, consult with your counsel or your consultants or whoever you're working with and make sure it actually qualifies as wellness testing, or you can find yourself in some hot water.
Yeah, in my business, I've had a lot of clients who want to avoid the federal laws prohibiting remuneration for referrals by doing cash pay for direct-to-consumer testing. You always want to be careful of state laws that might apply. Texas, for example, has the Texas Solicitation of Patient Act. And the reason why my clients or some clients that I've seen wanting to do this, because if you're a new startup and you want to get your name out there, you want to get your brand, you want to, you know, kind of get your, just need to try to kind of get your foot into the market. One way to do that is through that, you know, kind of mass sales rep, or, you know, the other referral sources that you'd like to in other industries that you're allowed to kind of provide some kind of remuneration for that referral network. But, you know, Texas has the Texas Solicitation of Patient Act. There's also many states have a commercial bribery law. So even if you're doing cash pay only and you're paying physicians for referrals, physicians are in a fiduciary capacity, and so you could be committing a commercial bribery as a criminal act. This is slightly related when we talk about, you know, there's a Forest Park case in North Texas. Now, they were engaged with third-party payers, but they had tried to carve that. Those individuals who were caught up in that case wanted to carve out Medicare as, you know, excluded Medicare reimbursement from the scheme. But the commercial bribery statute in Texas was used as a predicate offense under the Travel Act in order to, you know, have a federal enforcement of that scheme. So, again, when you think about, you know, even if you're excluding certain payers, you don't necessarily avoid all the potential landmines out there.
Yeah, don't bother with the carve-out. It does not work. I mean, the
definitely
OIG
not after ECRA.
Right. The OIG has never seen a – well, that's true – has never seen a carve-out that it likes. And they're harder and harder, you know, with ECRA being on the scene now too. And I just want to add on that test kit thing. I do have a client who has been subject to FDA enforcement around a collection kit that's composed of, you know, FDA – what's the right word? I'm not an FDA lawyer. Approved,
the
registered.
Components are medical devices.
Yes,
yeah.
The components are medical devices. So that is that's not just a, you know, talking head lawyer problem. That is like an actual real world potential issue.
Well, now that we highlighted all those issues on that,
we're gonna run away, yeah. Throw the bomb and run away.
Well, I mean, I'll emphasize it like I did in the beginning, because I focus a lot of my practice on the telehealth and digital health tech in that space. The only way for that model and remote care to exist is to be able to figure out how to offer these test services specifically in that capacity, right? It is a model of both either cash pay or third-party reimbursement. It is important, it is imperative to success of being able to provide care and equity, you know, in this country and around the world. And there are ways to do it. Just, you know, some of the issues that we just raised are, you know, need to be top of mind when doing it and offering those services. So we'll switch over to payer claim.
Can I add one thing? Sorry, just... You know, and on that point, like a lot of the companies now that are taking risk on patient populations are really looking at diagnostics as a way to sort of bring down costs. Like I've seen MA plans ask providers to go provide certain testing to patients because they haven't had something checked based on their claims data review. And so there is a little bit, it's sort of slow in the lab space, but this shift to sort of bringing in, particularly when it helps with preventative care, lab testing, and payers and people who are at risk for these patients wanting to bring in people to test them for different things.
So next topic that was desired to have a speak on was payer claims, denials, audits, recoupments. We're seeing a lot of that, obviously, but we wanted to touch upon specific activities that we're seeing and kind of highlight them and for you. And so I'll turn it over to Karen for some of the things that she's been seeing more recently.
Yeah, it's actually, the thing that I've seen the most recently is related to the topic we just discussed, which is consumer-initiated testing and billing payers for consumer-initiated testing, which is why we're saying you have to be really careful if you're going to do that, because payers are taking the position because, the patient is just meeting, briefly with a provider and then getting a test result and not necessarily, having the opportunity to go back to the doctor. Who does that anyway? You go to the doctor and you get your lab test. A lot of times you never talk to them again. You just, somebody in the office calls and says, everything's fine. And this really isn't any different than that. But I know that payers are denying on the basis that the testing's not medically necessary because it's not, the result's not used in the, care and ongoing treatment of the patient. And, there are definitely ways to dispute that, of course. And it depends on the type of testing, I think. But, I've seen it in the context of HIV testing and patients who need the HIV test because they want to, get on a PrEP regimen. And so once you get your result, you don't need to go back to a physician for that. You get your negative result, and then you go get your, your medication. So, so there's that. So you just have to be really careful if you're going to bill for testing that's consumer-initiated. And then the other thing I'll just quickly mention is I have had payer audits where, going back to the issue on the test kit, the payers have taken the position that because the test kit's not FDA approved, that they don't have to pay for the test because it's experimental, it's investigational experimental, which is nonsense.
On my end, I'll kind of touch upon some things new that I've seen, and they're kind of hurting my head. The Department of Justice does that often, but specifically in HRSA, I have seen allegations specifically in even indictments talking about HRSA billing and COVID testing, lab tests, right? Mm-hmm. And what hurts my head in reading it was, number one, they're using language about submitting tests that weren't medically necessary. Well, I think we all know that was the exact framework for the CARES Act to not, in fact, require a medical necessity. And a clinician determines it appropriate, this whole framework, not to mention, the moving target, goalposts, or whatever, you want to use. That one is concerning to me that they would otherwise move so forward so aggressively and not know the law that they cite. And then number two was with respects to submitting claims and being a false claim that you're submitting because the person, in fact, wasn't uninsured.
Yeah, there's been a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking
How many claims were submitted and then not denied but rejected because they're like, no, we have a process. UHC had the system to say that person has coverage. Go this. And in fact, they provided that information where that person, the coverage that person had. So to suggest the submission of that claim because the person in fact had insurance and you submitted numerous claims like that as being a False Claims Act violation. Those are things that we're now seeing play out, shake out, probably in the last year or so, that are concerning.
and HRSA is doing, it's, some of you may have been subject to them, but HRSA is doing their own audits as well, or they have a contractor who's doing the audits. And I mean, that the audits are flawed in so many ways, I don't even know where to begin. But, you know, the heart of it is, it's just a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking about how you determine someone was uninsured. Like, I have a client who they spent, a good amount of money to use a service, an insurance verification company, a reputable one. I don't want to advertise for anyone, so I won't tell you who it was, but a reputable insurance verification company, and yet HRSA's contractor is trying to say, you know, like the bulk of the patients in the sample weren't, they shouldn't have been paid for them because the people weren't insured.
The other thing that I'm seeing, Keith and Daniel, but anything, but
oh,
I'm
insured.
But
sorry.
Also, I mean, a lot of the, you know, PCR, especially with UTI testing, and the balance between that, obviously it's significantly more expensive than the what they call the gold standard. But the way that the payers, both on the government and the commercial payers, are in conducting those audits, I haven't seen anything to the level of, well, actually I have, to the level of that's actually a False Claims Act violation, submitting these claims. A lot of this has to do with, from what I've learned and delved into it, is the treating providers actually don't fully process the distinction between what is being offered in the PCR test and an ICS, so that's a complicating factor in this. Again, though, we've talked about it a number of times. We've seen it over and over again. I was making comments earlier at a Zyphon presentation about the reliance upon the provider, the treating provider, documenting things properly, mm-hmm. ordering things properly, that not only trigger an audit and overpayment, but now, unfortunately, is getting to the level of potentially putting some of these labs and in the context of False Claims Act violation and investigations that are not, that are burdensome at a minimum and can be, put some companies out of business.
I can echo the PCR testing piece. Not necessarily just audits, but like a lot of payers have certainly clamped down on their coverage policies for PCR testing. And so where they used to cover, more broad panels or more larger numbers of targets, they're limiting them to just 5 or 6, the lowest level codes. Practitioners are not that interested in changing their behavior and what they're ordering because they like all the information that they're getting.
Mm-hmm. And how quickly.
Yeah, and how quickly, right? And so I have a number of clients who are struggling with this because the payers are not only saying the tests aren't covered, but they're saying that it wasn't medically necessary, meaning the EOBs show no patient responsibility, limiting the lab's ability to go even bill the patient. And not only that, like just, anecdotally, if the payer covers 5 targets, shouldn't they cover 5 targets and then the patient pay for the, targets 6 through 10? And so I have a number of clients who are struggling with that dynamic and, whether or not, the payers should be adjusting the codes to what they cover and charging the differential as opposed to just saying, oh, no, we don't cover it because they wanted 10 tests. And then, of course, the issue with having, as a parent, like if my kid's really sick and I'm really busy, like I want to know what's wrong, I might pay for the bigger test, right? But documenting that and having labs have some way to sort of support that, and practitioners don't want to deal with that, which,
I think the key is, and many of us advise on this, and just even looking at the way that you're framing your test requisition forms, the way that you're ensuring that the accuracy of the test orders, information that comes in when it comes into the lab and when you're sessioning and you see there's inconsistency in that documentation, unfortunately, it's on you to have a coordinated process for addressing that, reaching back out to the ordering provider and treating provider to clarify are their staff. So we have about 7 minutes left. Want to touch upon, one last topic is the digital pathology piece of the puzzle, and I'll just throw some comments out there. The first one is I really liked that we had Ren was talking about, and Kliak, the recommendations, right, about being in digital pathology and remote care, not having to have a CLIA certificate for those locations. Obviously, we're operating under a CMS waiver right now for digital pathology, so that's still in place. It doesn't exist for anything else other than that on that end. So
can I add to that point? People seem to sort of forget that the waiver covers CLIA rules. It doesn't translate to reimbursement rules. And so if a pathologist is not on site, you have to think about the Medicare and a markup rule and whether or not they're sharing a practice with the, you know, whoever's billing for it. And so I have had a lot of clients think, oh, there's a CMS waiver. I can do, you know, they can be remote for everything. And you have there's a few other things you need to pay attention to if your pathologists are sitting remotely compared to who's billing for it.
I think that's very, very good advice, especially just acknowledging because of the purchase arrangements that you have, and then more and more pathologists because of the lack of them, and you know, 1099 contractor arrangements. Understanding that these anti-markup rules, both at the federal and state levels as well, exist, and Medicare has crazy payment locality pieces when you split up the TCPC. So, all things that we don't really have time to get into, but that you need to be cognizant of. And the one thing I just want on the digital pathology side is that I wanted to highlight is whole slide imaging, WSI, and that piece of the puzzle. I don't know how it got out there, but I have seen multiple emails, people and analyses where it says that that is a component of an LDT and that you don't need FDA approval for digital imaging of a slide to be able to read, you know, remotely. That is not true. And that is something that I think I just wanted to highlight because I've seen enough of it within the last year or so. That I wanted to, you know, clarify that piece of the puzzle so everyone's aware of the position that the FDA would take on that. And the process by which this goes through and how LDTs will maybe utilizing that technology going forward is something important to note.
Should we answer some of these?
We want to answer questions? Sure.
Yep, we've got
5 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have one that you want to key up?
Well, one is, I know Keith has been quoted in the DARC report on this topic. What are some compliance solutions to compensate a lab sales team based on their performance?
Thank you for that.
The ultimate question.
Yeah, you know, it used to be under the anti-kickback statute, the bona fide employee safe harbor that you can compensate somebody basically on commissions. That's the historical payment methodology. Then Ecker came around and just said, you can't do that anymore. Labs historically have done a lot of productivity tracking of employees, labs of all sizes. The idea is that we can't have direct or indirect consideration of the revenue generation, right? That's what Ecker says you can't do. But are there other activities that sales reps engage in that would lead to revenue generation, things that you want them to be doing that don't directly track that metric that the OIG has said you can't do and that ECRA says you can't do? Are we using our marketing team has developed some specific materials. Are we making sure that they're using those materials? Our physicians are calling about, billing issues. Are they calling about testing issues? What's our response time to that? I used to work in insurance. I mean, we would track to the minute our response times for customer complaints. So there are just so many tools out there for tracking productivity that you would think and you'd want to craft your bonus or your compensation amounts to lead towards revenue generation, but you're not directly compensating someone towards revenue generation. And we talk about Genetox from the DARC report. I think a key there is people transition, if you haven't already transitioned, in that deferred prosecution agreement, you don't want to clearly match somebody's current compensation to what their commission-based compensation was. That kind of, matching is they say the OIG saw through it and it was held against them in that case.
going through the questions, I think there's only one other one that I think on topic and address. It says, can a physician practice currently billing the PC in a TC-PC arrangement purchase the TC to bill globally? Well, number one, if you delve into Stark, Stark specifically identifies the fact that even, well, this is going into the advisory opinion, and so the Stark specifically says it would be permissible for you for the laboratory that's actually ultimately Path Lab, ultimately billing globally, to purchase the TC from the referring provider. It says it, it's in there. Now the question is, it says that in Stark and says that in that piece of the puzzle in the Federal Register, how does it play over into the AKS piece? And how does it play over into the reimbursement piece, right? The problem that we have is each one of the payers in the reimbursement system treat it differently. Medicare has a very complicated process and payment localities and same provider about billing globally. But as we know, many commercial payers are transitioning towards global bill. So what does that otherwise mean? I think that's one of the commercially reasonable factors for which you would purchase TC from another lab, even if they were referring, because you have to bill globally. You can't bill separately. Anyone else have any?
Well, I'll just add, I think it's so fact-dependent, right? Like, if the lab is going to go in and set up the physician office lab and manage it and provide the techs and
that's
provide
the
equipment, and then they're going to pay them to do the TC because it's, you know, it can get pretty wonky pretty fast. But if the, you know, there's a practice and they're providing a legitimate service, they're doing it and they're going to get paid for that service, and sort of depending on the facts and circumstances, you might be able to get comfortable with it.
We have some unanswered questions here, so we'll all stay. And if you want your answer to one of these questions, we're up here happy to answer them.
Thank you all for attending.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.